Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Catherine Tataquin, Executive Director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, who examines President Trump's attack on immigrants and his demand for a border wall, which has led to the current government shutdown. Lee Chapman of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who assesses H.R. 1, the first major package of legislation proposed by the new Democratic House majority, which calls for voting rights protection and ethics reform. And Anstress Farewell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League, who discusses city parking issues, which impacts sustainable public transportation and urban planning. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Soon after being sworn into office, Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro launched an assault on indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest. The new president issued a 120-day decree putting the agricultural ministry in charge of indigenous affairs, a change which impacts nearly 1 million people. The ministry, now overseeing the management of public forests, will also have the power to rule on land claims. Environmental activists blasted the move, saying it will increase deforestation and spark violence against indigenous people. Land claims were previously handled by the Indigenous Affairs Agency. Alarming many, Bolsonaro's health minister, Luis Enrique Mendetta, pledged to cut government health spending for indigenous communities. According to Amazon Watch, President Bolsonaro has his eyes on developing the mineral-rich indigenous territory known as Raposa Sierra do Sol. Analysts worry that the world's fourth-largest democracy could drift back to military dictatorship. The pro-Bolsonaro governor of Rio de Janeiro, for example, is calling for the deployment of helicopter-borne snipers to execute suspected criminals. In 2018, the Rio police killed over 1,400 people. That number is expected to rise in the new year. In the ultimate act of protest, a Tunisian television reporter set himself on fire in a chilling cell phone video posted on Christmas Eve from the city of Kasserine. The 32-year-old reporter complained of widespread hunger and massive unemployment. According to the New Yorker magazine, the reporter, Abdurazzak Zorgi, committed suicide just days after the 8th anniversary of the Arab Spring, which was triggered when a Tunisian street vendor set himself on fire in protest over corruption and youth unemployment. The Arab Spring rocked the Middle East with citizen uprisings in Egypt and Bahrain and sparked civil wars in Syria and Yemen. The self-immolation of the local TV reporter led to renewed protests in cities across Tunisia and debate over what to do about massive unemployment. Tunisia, a former French colony, emerged out of the Arab Spring as the most credible democracy in the Arab world. However, successive Tunisian governments have failed to create enough jobs for the educated, to address pressing needs ranging from housing to health services, and to provide for a society's rising expectations. Before dawn each morning, hundreds of Mexican-American schoolchildren cross the border, passing U.S. Border Patrol officers to ride school buses to classes in Luna County, New Mexico. The nearly 850 children who cross each weekday are American citizens who live in or near Palomas with their Mexican parents. Mexican children have attended these New Mexico schools for decades and are warmly welcomed by local officials. In recent years, more parents deported from the U.S. to Mexico have moved close to the border so their U.S.-born children can go to U.S. schools in order to receive a better education. It is an arrangement that has been in place for generations, long enough to become normal and accepted in a region where economic and ancestral ties bridge the man-made line that divides the two nations. The closest Mexican hospital in this remote border area is in Juarez, 2 hours to the east, so in the event of medical emergencies, U.S. Customs officers let patients through to go to the hospital 45 minutes north in Deming. Arsenio Romero, superintendent of the Deming Public Schools, thinks everyone in America should spend a morning in his border bus stop. While the immigration debate has turned toxic, he says, watching five-year-olds walk through customs with passports hanging from their necks might change perceptions about who belongs in this country. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
With the partial government shutdown entering its third week, pressure is growing in Washington for a resolution of the political battle over President Trump's demand for more than $5 billion from Congress to build his wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. While both the newly Democratic-controlled House of Representatives and GOP-controlled Senate had approved continuing budget resolutions to reopen the nine federal departments closed down, the president has refused to end the shutdown until Congress meets his demands. The shutdown affects more than 800,000 federal workers in the Departments of Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, Homeland Security, Housing and Urban Development, Interior, State, Transportation, and Treasury. Many of these workers have been furloughed, while others deemed essential must work without pay. Ironically, the shutdown has weakened staffing of the TSA, which enforces security at the nation's airports. In a misleading primetime address to the nation on January 8th, Trump argued that the U.S. faces a national security crisis on the southern border that must be addressed by building the wall he pledged would be paid for by Mexico. Your reporter spoke with Catherine Tuktakin, executive director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Here she discusses Trump's attack on immigrants, the forced separation of families, and the current shutdown, as she challenges the assertion that a crisis exists on the U.S.-Mexico border.
This isn't the first time that we've seen him use this tactic to hold people hostage. So in the past, he's held, almost 800,000 Dreamers, undocumented youth who benefited from the DACA program, hostage over the wall. He has, I think, tried to hold children, the separation of children from their parents at the border, as hostage to his agenda. It is extremely frustrating. And when you look at the human impact on immigrants, on children, and now on hundreds of thousands of federal workers and their families who are going without pay and have an uncertain future, as a being held hostage for what was his campaign promise. And we've seen, some news in the last week that actually the phrase "build the wall" was being used by his campaign as a way to focus his attention as an undisciplined candidate when he was campaigning. But what we saw was that the phrase, the call to build the wall, was used, over and over in campaign rallies. And essentially, it was a code for, keep the immigrants out. It was a code for his anti-immigration policies. And now we see this campaign slogan or promise, an attempt to turn that into policy. And of course, it's been met with, lots of resistance, certainly from the Democratic Party, but also I think increasingly frustration by members of the Republican Party as well. A major critique from many sides on the just the concept of a wall as national security, but also looking more broadly at what a wall means in terms of militarization of the border. It's at what border enforcement has actually meant over a number of years in terms of increasing the likelihood of migrant deaths, human rights violations, damage to border communities, to the environment. It's a very fragile environment at the border, and there's already been considerable damage just by the encroachment of a more militarized border.
Catherine, I wonder if you would respond to Donald Trump and his administration's characterization of a crisis, an emergency, a national emergency on our southern border. I've read accounts where there's actually fewer immigrants crossing the border than there were years ago. Provide a reality check for our listeners, if you would, about the quote-unquote crisis or emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The reality is that border crossings have declined over the last 12 years. And if there is a crisis, what we're seeing is certainly the humanitarian crisis that has emerged in Central America. And I think many people by now have become more familiar with the problem of persistent poverty, of violence, and what's described as the Northern Triangle, the countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, which are identified as among the most dangerous countries in the entire world. And what we've seen of the Central American exodus, also described as the migrant caravan, are really families who have been leaving Central America and traveling as a group, because that is the safest way for them to travel, to flee those conditions, and to try to reach safe haven. They are no different from the millions of people around the world who have similarly sought safety, leaving situations of crisis. So if there is a crisis, it's there. And we are, have been using this false narrative of a national security or manufacturing a crisis, really by not implementing a strong humanitarian response, by cutting back on access to refugee resettlement, by trying to close the doors to asylum seekers. So we have been reneging, the United States government, that is, on really our national laws with regards to asylum, but also our obligations under international agreements to provide safe havens to those who qualify. So it is a bit of a manufactured crisis. I think there's been news over the last couple of days when the White House was trying to argue that there were thousands of terrorists trying to cross the border. They identified thousands of terrorists, and apparently, the information that they were using was the fact that there are over 3,000 people who are on a no-fly list. These are people who've been identified for various reasons, including people who might have the same name as someone who is identified as a suspected terrorist, who have been identified because they've sought to fly. They're not people who have who are crossing the border, and the State Department has had to admit that, in fact, since 9/11, we have not caught one terrorist crossing the U.S.-Mexico border.
That was Catherine Taktakin, Executive Director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Learn more about national organizations challenging Trump's crackdown on immigrants and refugees and working for comprehensive immigration reform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The new Democratic Party majority, which took control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 8 years on January 3rd, quickly introduced their first major package of legislation, H.R. 1, on January 4th. The bill addresses three major issues: the protection and expansion of voting rights, campaign finance reform, and strengthening the government's ethics laws. The legislation's proposals include overturning the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, public financing of federal campaigns, requiring the president and vice president, both candidates and office holders, to disclose 10 years of tax returns, establishing a new national automatic voter registration system, outlawing partisan gerrymandering in federal elections, and prohibiting partisan-driven purges of voter rolls. Your reporter spoke with Lee Chapman, Voting Rights Program Director, with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who assesses the package of proposals in H.R. 1, with a focus on challenging voter suppression laws and prospects for the bill's success, given that President Trump and the GOP-controlled Senate are highly unlikely to support this legislation.
So H.R. 1 is also known as For the People Act, and it's a bold, ambitious bill that was just introduced by House Democrats last week, and it's one of the first major bills of this new Congress. And the bill is really about putting the government back in the hands of the people. It does three things. So one, it makes it easier, not harder, for people to vote in our country. Two, it aims to end the big dominance of money in politics. And three, it has provisions ensuring that public officials work for the public interest. But at the leadership conference, we're primarily focused on the voting rights provision of the bill because our democracy works the best when everyone can participate. I wanted to talk about some of the key provisions that are potentially really transformative in this bill. So one of them is automatic voter registration. So under H.R. 1, it would allow for there to be nationwide automatic voter registration. So that means when someone goes to their DMV or any agency in their state to either update their driver's license, their information would be automatically sent to the Secretary of State's office so that they're registered. And this would have an impact of having more than 50 million more additional people on the voter rolls. So this is a huge transformational change if this were to become law. Another key reform to highlight is H.R. 1 would also restore the right to vote for people with felony convictions around the country. So there are some states where if you have a felony conviction, you lose your right to vote permanently. And this impacts about 5 million people around the country. Under H.R. 1, if this went into effect, we would have not only the 50 more million people on the rolls through automatic voter registration, but there would also be 5 million people with previous felony convictions who could participate in our democracy.
Lee, maybe you could describe the progress that's being made in this newly Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives to bring up legislation that would restore the Voting Rights Act. And what are the prospects in the U.S. Senate for doing the same thing?
So actually, since the Supreme Court gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, there has been an effort to introduce legislation to restore and modernize the Voting Rights Act, because it's important that we have Section 5 preclearance again, so we can stop that laws from going into place before they do. Terry Sewell, Representative Terry Sewell from Alabama, she's been the main sponsor of the Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is a piece of legislation that has been introduced in previous Congresses, and she's planning on introducing it again in this Congress. The key thing about your question about the Senate, what's the possibility of this passing in the Senate is, voting rights should be a nonpartisan issue. No matter what political party that you're a member of, you should want everyone in our democracy to participate. And unfortunately, voting rights has become something that has been politicized over the last few years, but it shouldn't. If people care about economic justice or immigration reform or, education, every legislator should support restoring the Voting Rights Act and restore the key provisions of H.R. 1.
H.R. 1 is likely to pass in the House of Representatives, but the Republicans still control the Senate, and Donald Trump is still in the White House. I think from outside looking in, it appears that both the Senate and Trump would reject the set of reforms. Where does H.R. 1 go from here if it passes the House but gets blocked by the White House and the Senate?
Yeah, so it probably will pass the House relatively quickly. House Democrats have said that they are planning on voting on it within the next few weeks. It will go to the Senate. There will probably be a Senate companion bill that will be introduced. But I think this is a time where voters need to put pressure on their members of Congress that they have elected. It's time for voters to call your member of Congress, no matter if they're a Democrat or Republican, and say that you want this bill to pass, you want them to support this bill. So this is the pivotal moment where we can't just say, oh, it's never going to pass the Senate. we need to actually put public pressure on our elected members of Congress to make this a priority and to hold them accountable.
That was Lee Chapin, Voting Rights Program Director with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Learn more about H.R. 1 and its package of voting rights, campaign finance, and ethics reforms by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Years ago, the State of Connecticut Department of Transportation proposed to build a second parking garage adjacent to the existing one at New Haven's Union Station on what's now a ground-level surface parking lot as a way to attract single-occupancy drivers out of their cars and onto the train. Train service in this region includes Metro North to New York City, Amtrak offering service along the eastern seaboard, Shoreline East, and a new commuter line that travels north from New Haven to Hartford and Springfield, Massachusetts. But the train station garage proposal has always faced opposition from city officials and urban advocates who say the 1,000 cars it would take off the highways is a drop in the bucket, while adding 1,000 cars to city streets riding to the garage would create a gigantic bottleneck. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anstress Farrell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League, which sponsored a two-day event at the city's downtown library on January 4th, where planning experts and residents had a chance to provide feedback on the garage project. Farewell maintains that the funds to build the $60 million garage could be put to much better use elsewhere, framing the New Haven proposal in the context of national sustainable public transportation and urban planning goals.
We wrote a report back in 2016 to the DOT that said this was a very problematic project and that it wrote an environmental impact evaluation that really showed failure in every possible way for this project, for its impact on stormwater, air quality. They'd cut down every tree in the area, all of it gone. And even with that, they didn't have a plan for bus service. There wasn't a sufficient plan to make it safe for more people to ride bikes or walk in the area. So it was essentially a plan for 1,000 cars that would cost $60 million. They said that in order to increase access to Union Station, we needed to maximize the amount of parking we could build there. And I feel very strongly they've asked the wrong question. You need to first say, why do you want to increase access to Union Station? And the why is important. Is it because we're going to become a hub of the Northeast Corridor high-speed rail, for commuter rail, for all of the pieces that will need to fit together there? Once you answer that, then you say, what do we need to develop in the area to support all of those regional and local systems and make train service really work well for our New Haven residents in the region? If this is a $60 million plan that will simply take 1,000 cars a day off the highway, that does very little even for the highway. But you put 1,000 cars on Union Avenue at rush hour, and it's a disaster for everyone else that uses Union Avenue. In any other city, a parcel like this right next to the train station would be what realtors call a 100% lot. It's one of the most valuable pieces of land in the city. Can you imagine if New York knocked down the Pan Am building to build a mega parking garage? That's how we need to think of this, that when our train station was built in 1913, it was in the middle of a dense urban area with a street grid. It was all buildings and houses. And then we destroyed our trolley system and knocked down most of 60% of the buildings down there. So what we need to do is think of a proper thing that takes advantage of being at the train station, like a big mixed-use project. It could be a hotel conference center. It could be a corporate headquarters. So that would provide expansion of our tax base that we desperately need now. You know, we're facing extreme budget problems both in the state and the city. If you have followed the work of Norman Garrick of the Yukon Transportation Institute, one of the things that he has shown in his research and work is that as you expand parking, cities' tax base goes down, and also the number of jobs. And if you think about it, if you had, let's say, even a lab building, the value of that building and its equipment would be far beyond a parking garage. That's more taxes. Also, how many people work in a lab building or a hotel or a business center compared to a parking garage that's mostly automated? So cities that don't control the development of parking end up with reduced tax bases and fewer jobs. New Haven in the state, we cannot keep going in this direction. It's totally unsustainable. So this isn't right in terms of building a livable urban environment, but it also is very backwards and isn't attending to all of the best up-to-date research that's been available really since 2005 about the impact of parking garages on urban economies. So this is a big step backwards.
And I'm sure New Haven isn't the only city in the country that's facing these challenges.
Well, I think it's cities all over the country are realizing that the development practices of the redevelopment era that were focused on cars were actually destroying the economy and the livability of cities. So this is really central to a whole national movement reevaluating the impact of parking on cities. As many people say, parking is like the dark matter of a city, and it has distorted everything about the urban environment and set up habits of mind that actually don't go with livable cities. So, yes, this is a kind of intellectual battle and real political battle that cities are facing nationwide.
That was Anstress Farewell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League. Learn more about sustainable public transportation and urban design issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KOPA Res Radio in Pala, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.